Hello, I'm James Olson, author of The Whole Brain Path to Peace. My website is thewholebrainpath.com. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zohara Hieronymus, and I just loved being on this show, and she is such a great interview. I know you're going to enjoy whatever you listen to.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zoe Hieronymus, continuing our discussion of the clinical trials for mistletoe treatment at Johns Hopkins Hospital is Dr. Peter Hinderberger. Peter joins us this portion of the program to share his own use of mistletoe therapy for his own cancer patients. Dr. Hinderberger is a world-renowned anthroposophical and homeopathic general care practice physician. And I am grateful to say he is the medical director of the center I founded in 1985 called the Ruscomb Mansion Community Health Center, which our audience has heard about. And I'd also like to say, as a personal patient and friend, congratulations, Peter. We are so proud that all the work you've done all these decades is going to move, hopefully, to a place where more people can benefit. Thank you so much for your endurance.
So it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So tell us about this plant, this mysterious plant called mistletoe. Why is it helpful in overcoming cancer?
Well, mistletoe has been used for centuries in medicine. Actually, the Druids of olden times, they used mistletoe, and it was a sacred plant for them. They were not allowed to touch it when they harvested it. They had to use gloves and the special scissors or cuts or knives to harvest it at special times. So it has been around us for a long time. Actually, it's a very primitive plant. If you look at the leaves of mistletoe, you look at the top, you look at the bottom, it's identical, which is very rare. But it's an indication that it's a very old plant. And it's actually a primitive plant. And it's frankly not that attractive. It doesn't have, you know, flowers. It doesn't have a strong scent. It's a very simple plant. It also does not grow on the ground. It's a semi-parasite. Semi means that it doesn't destroy the host tree. They are actually quite healthy, but it depends on nutrients from the host tree. And mistletoe historically has been used for heart diseases, especially high blood pressure. It also has been used to thin the blood. But at the change of the 20th century, a man, Rudolf Steiner, and a woman, Ita Wegmann, a physician, they discovered that mistletoe actually can be used also for cancer. And modern research shows that mistletoe has substances that on the one side actively kill cancer cells. It's a cytotoxic substance. On the other hand, mistletoe produces lectins, and these lectins are proteins that bind to sugars, and lectins can be very bad. They actually can promote disease. It depends on what kind of sugar they bind, or they can be also very beneficiary, and mistletoe has lectins that are very beneficiary insofar that they bind to sugars that are an integral part to cancer cells, and they destroy these sugars so that the cancer cells cannot grow and multiply and get destroyed. But they also enhance killer cells and helper cells, and these killer cells and helper cells are cells in our body. They are part of the lymphocytes, white blood cells, that are very specialized, and they themselves, they kill cancer cells. So they belong to our immune system. So we can say that mistletoe has three functions. The one function is to actively destroy cancer cells. The other ones is through the lectins to destroy cancer cells, and also to enhance the immune function of our body.
Wow, that's a beautiful description of a plant that's a parasite. I mean, when you describe the plant itself, I was thinking that so much like what cancer cells do is they become a parasite on the host body.
That's actually a correct observation. A cancer is a parasite. the mistletoe, and a parasite then can invade and can multiply and destroy the host. Whereas mistletoe has a very, very slow it has a slow cycle. In other words, it's an evergreen. Mm-hmm. It does lose its leaves every 3 years.
How interesting. You know, it, when you were talking about its history and how many centuries it's been used, of course what comes to mind probably to most people is kissing under the mistletoe.
Yes.
So what's the association with that, that it's an evergreen?
Well, it actually, it has other characteristics that are really off. One of them is that the mistletoe, the berry ripens, is ripe at winter solstice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, it has a white berry. It's not attractive. It's actually poisonous. It's only special kind of bird, a sparrow, can eat that mistletoe berry. And then, you know, after it digests it, then it's excreted with fecal matter on a branch. And then the seed of this berry, which is sticky, sticks to the branch and goes and forms a root, and then that's how it propagates.
How beautiful!
But I think the mistletoe and kissing under the mistletoe branch has to do with the berry that ripens in the winter, at winter solstice.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of mistletoe therapy for cancer, you've been using this for a long time. Describe for the audience the various ways mistletoe can be used.
Well, in the late 70s, I worked in a hospital in Switzerland, an inpatient hospital. They have about 65 beds, and they specialize in cancer treatment, in complementary cancer treatment. So I have seen patients there who had cancer, who went through chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, but also patients who decided not to do anything and completely rely on mistletoe. And the effect of mistletoe that I saw, especially in cancer patients who went through chemotherapy already, or radiation or surgery, was absolutely phenomenal, and helps the well-being of the patient. It has effects like it improves weight, improves appetite, it normalizes sleep, improves in general quality of life. It also improves mood and courage and initiative, and it reduces the pain-related, the cancer-related tumor, besides killing cancer cells. So even patients who have like stage 4, what we call terminal cancer, and are cachectic, that means they lose weight, and they still benefit from taking mistletoe. Not because it's really beyond killing the cancer, but just for the remaining quality of life.
I was reading, as I mentioned to Evelise earlier tonight, that I read online in preparation for tonight's discussion some of the medical studies that have been done on mistletoe in Europe. And it listed breast cancer, lung cancer, various 1 through 4 stage cancers, with almost all the studies showing exactly what you just described, improved survival and improved quality of life. And the, you know, to my horror, like your own, I'm sure, many of the patients who have benefited, when we think of all the people who perhaps could still be alive if they were able to have access to mistletoe, It's very heartbreaking, really. And so I think it adds to my excitement, Peter, for the fact that you and others who have been using this have made such a difference, enough to inspire a person like Evelise with this rebounded health to move forward and bring you and others at Johns Hopkins together. So talk to us a little bit about this collaborative research that's going to be done.
Well, I'm excited about it myself. Initially, I was a little skeptic because Johns Hopkins is really an institution that is a top research institution for Western medicine. But I was really excited when the oncologist, Luis Diaz, approached me and said that he's interested in doing a study on mistletoe. And it's not the first study at Hopkins that is done with botanicals, actually. So they have experience with that. And I think with the experience, it comes also, it's also helpful that the research actually will be done, because one of the most difficult things with botanicals is to convince the FDA that this is worthwhile to do. We have to submit a lot of research, and as you said, you know, there are decades of research on mistletoe. One of the biggest ones was published in 1998, that they followed more than 10,000 patients at the University of Heidelberg with rectal cancer, breast cancer, bronchial cancer, colon cancer, stomach cancer, and they paired patients who did take mistletoe and those who didn't, and actually those who did take mistletoe had an extended life of more than 4.5 years. So we have studies that we can submit to the FDA, but then it's also very difficult to standardize mistletoe or any biological extract. That's the next problem, the next hurdle that we have to cross. And the third one is to get the finances, because, you know, none of the big pharma, they will support that. So we have to approach funds. And again, I think Hopkins and also, of course, Believe Big, it's wonderful that they support this. With the help of Hopkins and Believe Big, I think we will get the money together to realize this study.
It will be such an important addition to medical history in this country.
And, it will, yes.
And again, you know, I keep saying I'm so proud of you. I am so proud of you, and I am so grateful you have been my doctor my whole adult life my family, because you bring to it a certain humility that not everybody in the medical community has, and you bring to it this beautiful training in anthroposophy and Rudolf Steiner's work, as well as homeopathy, which I can't speak more highly of as a medical art. Why do you think so many people get cancer, Peter?
That's such a good question. It's a real epidemic. It's a real epidemic. You know, like Nixon declared the war on cancer, what was it like? 50 years ago, 40 years ago, I think. And he said that cancer will be eradicated by 2015. Well, it will not. And I really think that, you know, a lot of things that we are exposed to nowadays in modern life, actually, it's like a perfect storm. You know, as individual substances, if we eat them or inhale them or are exposed to them, as individual substances, they might not do the damage, but if we're exposed to 2, 3, or 4, then cancer can occur. And a lot of things, I think, have to do with diet, and I'm thinking especially of sugar, which, you know, it's not really a very popular theme, but I do think that we consume way, way too much sugar. And that makes our body acidic, and as you know, our blood has a pH of 7.4, which is a little bit on the alkaline side. So when we eat things that are acidic, our body is constantly in this fight-and-flight mode to restore that pH that is more alkaline, and I think that stress on the body is a contributing factor to cancer.
Mm-hmm. And I know just from knowing you and listening to you speak over the decades is that having a rhythmic life is so important. And maybe we can touch on that when we come back. We have to take a little break. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to be part of this amazing breakthrough, we hope, for the benefit of all the people in this country, a clinical trial of mistletoe for cancer at Johns Hopkins, you can take part Saturday, April 27th, 2013. The keynote speaker is Dr. Luis Diaz, and Dr. Hinderberger will also be a speaker. I'm asked to just tell you all to go to believebig.org, to their website, and follow their links for the event rather than my promoting the times and the place. And it's also linked on the front page of our medical center, Ruscombe, RUSCOMBE.org, as well as our radio program, 21st21stcenturyradio.com.
Hello, I'm Bill Sweet of Spindrift Research. Our website is spindriftresearch.org. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Zoe Hieronymus, and we're looking forward to having more of you open-minded people listen in.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. That was Bill Sweet, and he agrees with Eva Leese, who is the founder and chairman of the Believe Big Foundation we spoke to earlier on the importance and power of prayer. She described how really prayer has had so much to do, in addition to the use of mistletoe therapy, which we're talking about now with Dr. Peter Hinderberger, in her overcoming her own stage 4 cancer. So, Peter, before the break, I mentioned something you often talk about, which is the importance of a rhythmic lifestyle. Can you describe to our audience what you mean by that?
Well, you know, everything in the human body follows organ-specific rhythms. And rhythm is one of the archetypal laws of life, like nutrition, like water. We need water, we need food, but we also need rhythm. As a matter, you know, we hear of these tortures that people are tortured, they can't sleep. And after two nights of a sleepless time, they break down and they're destroyed. And I really think that with the arrival of electricity, we can manipulate time. We can go to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, watch a movie until then, and get up at 5 o'clock again. And when you believe that, when you think of that for 10,000 years minus the last 200, we woke up, we got up at dawn, or actually I have to revise this because a couple of years ago I was in Haiti and in a place where there was no electricity, and I thought back then, yes, we woke up at dawn and went to bed at when it got night, but what I found that what woke us up around 5 o'clock in the morning was actually the rooster right in front of the window. You can't sleep through the rooster. So historically, we woke up with the rooster, and we went to bed when, you know, what can you do at candlelight or with an other light that is not electricity? You talk a little bit for 15 minutes, and then you go to bed. So we had this rhythm. We also had a rhythm that we knew when we would eat, when we would have a snack, when we would work, and so on. It's like animals in the wild. I've never been to a safari in Kenya, but I have been told that the guide can tell you at the watering hole when the elephants would come and when the giraffes would come and so on, and they're pretty much on time. So we lost that inner, we still have that inner clock, but we lost the connection to that inner clock. And again, that causes our fight and flight mechanism to kick in. And I think, you know, what you mentioned with prayers and meditation and a rhythmic lifestyle, that's just part of our integral well-being, plan of well-being.
When you have done things that maybe other people don't understand, like homeopathy, which to me is the most beautiful healing art form there is, using extracts, essences of plants and minerals and diluting them in water and water holding the signature and all the wonderful research that's been done on it. How does this step in bringing mistletoe as a clinical trial to Hopkins make you feel?
Well, I really think so. Mistletoe is actually not homeopathic. It is homeopathically prepared, but in a very low potency. So on the one side, it does modulate our physical body. On the other side, it definitely has an effect on the etheric or the chi or the vital force or whatever you want to call this energy that keeps us alive and keeps us healthy. And I really think that, and I truly believe with the setup of the trial, the way it will be done, it will be successful. We will be able to prove that mistletoe will prolong the life of cancer patients and also help the quality of life. And that will be a study that you can't just, brush under the carpet. And other researchers have to pick it up and take it up. And this will be opening the door for mistletoe and other biologicals. And there are tons of them, like mushrooms, that also have these lectins. And this is, to my knowledge, the first... I mean, I know for mistletoe, it's the first time in the United States that a study will be done on a university level. So that's very exciting, and I think it will be a breakthrough for complementary medicine in general.
Yeah, when you read the list, and this is, when I founded the center, you know my own story, and so do some of our audience. But when you think about the suffering, sometimes so needlessly, people go through because they don't know about complementary medicine. They don't know about homeopathy or acupuncture or the value of nutrition or sleeping well or finding a job they really love. Mistletoe, ladies and gentlemen, you can go Google search it yourself and you will be shocked when you discover that here's this product that has helped so many millions of people around the world, but not necessarily in our country, unless you came to a place like our senator, the Ruska Mansion, that people generally feel better. There's an increased appetite and increased weight. People are less tired. They have more energy. There's reduced pain. There's better sleep pattern. There's feeling more hopeful and motivated. There's reduced adverse effects from chemotherapy and radiotherapy. There's reduced risk of cancer spreading and its recurrence. And there's increased life expectancy. It's just a remarkable story of a hidden healing gem that you've used for so many decades. So since the 1970s, when you first encountered this in Switzerland, Peter, how have you seen it with your own patient population in general? Because the way it's administered varies. You know, some people can learn to inject it themselves. Tell us about that, the therapeutic itself.
Yeah, before I go to this, actually, it's not hidden in Europe. I mean, every third oncologist in Germany and Switzerland, every third oncologist, actually recommends mistletoe.
So yeah, I meant it was hidden
very
in this country.
There.
That's
in this
fantastic.
Country, yeah, in this country we do have a cancer mafia in a way, that that suppresses information. We're very insular here. But I have used mistletoe in my practice and I started in Switzerland for more than 30 years. And it's given by injection under the skin, like, millions of diabetics do. So you can do it yourself. It's you don't need your husband to do it. Also, it's a wonderful bonding experience, I think. But it's also something that you can't overdose because the dose is specifically, individually titrated. And... You can choke on your vitamins, but there's really no problem with giving something subcutaneously. The needle will not break off. I have never seen this in my 30 plus years. And under the skin, you will not hit an artery or a nerve. So it's a very safe way to give it. Orally, you cannot do it because orally it's too toxic for the digestive tract. But anybody can do that from a 12-year-old on upward. So it's a very safe and effective way to help cancer. With the concentrations that we have available here in the United States, it's not really an alternative to cancer. Like at the cancer centers in Switzerland and Germany, they give it intravenously, higher concentration. They keep a patient in the hospital over an observation period of 10 days, and they give intravenous mistletoe, and then it can cause side effects. And these are the side effects you read about online, like headaches, malaise, fever, chills. you will not see this with subcutaneous mistletoe use.
Mm-hmm. I also saw that they do intratumor injection into the tumor site itself.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I've always wondered why there hasn't been more of that with organ cancers in general. But so when you then look at the whole picture, talk to us just a bit that we have remaining about how medical trials are done, because does it also include a placebo in some of the patient population?
Yes, but not in this one, because what Hopkins is doing is using a very rare renal cancer where they have a success rate below 10% with the treatment they can offer. It's not a chemotherapy treatment. This cancer is not responding to chemotherapy. It's an immune-modulating treatment that also enhances the killer cells, the helper cells. And they have already the data available. So what they're trying to do is to use these same patients with that rare cancer, and in addition to this IP2, it's called, they also will give, in addition to that, they will give mistletoe. And then if they can improve the survival rate by 8 to 10%, that will be a success. I just said something wrong. It's not IP2. It's IL, interleukin-2, that they will give to these cancer patients. But mm-hmm. there will not be a placebo involved.
Interesting. So it's really a direct study with direct outcomes, and we're not yep. finding out if somebody believes it's true.
No.
That's wonderful. I mean, that's a beautiful model, because one of the problems I've always had, as you know, is when some people should be given a therapy that's available, but they're not, and they're given something that doesn't exist or a placebo,
yeah.
it's always sort of morally concerned me. Well,
I think it's not ethical, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And years ago, well, a story for another time. Peter, again, congratulations. It's just so wonderful to see that Ruscom and your work and Evalise's experience, like other patients of yours, is really bringing this now, hopefully, to the forefront of cancer treatment all across America. I just think it's splendid.
Yeah, and I think so, too. The time is just right for it, yes.
Well, it's a beautiful testimony to your lifelong service in medicine. And Dr. Hinderberger, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You know, ladies and gentlemen, again, I wasn't able to promote the event for a variety of reasons, but mostly because they want to be sure that people who go are really interested in being able to help. There'll be an opportunity for people to make a contribution that evening. There'll be wonderful food served. Learn more at www.believebig.org. They also have a Facebook, www.facebook.com/believebig. It's also at our website, www.ruscombe.org, and on 21st Century Radio, www.21stcenturyradio.org. You know, I loved what what Evalise Page said as a patient in her own journey, that getting over fear, I think, which we all know as humans, no matter what kind of illness we've had or our children have had, that fear can be incapacitating. I loved her way of describing that with her husband's support, and he put together this beautiful prayer list for her, that it's at www.believebig.org, that together they were able to face the challenge of a life-threatening description of life, that she had four-stage cancer. And as Dr. Hinderberger has now described to us why a rhythmic life that once all humans had, we really have to work to achieve. And I joke, you know, now that I'm almost 60, that I finally have a very rhythmic life, mostly because I don't have the energy I did. So I don't stay up till 2 a.m. anymore, Dr. Peter, and get up at 5:30 a.m. to start work. I go to bed around 10:30 p.m. like a good doobie that I should, and I get up with the dogs, not the rooster. I want to encourage everybody to take good care of yourself, to love others when they are sick, and to know that places like the Ruscom Mansion Community Health Center in Baltimore exist for the sole reason of helping everybody in their healing journey.
o'clock. And breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Paul.